Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to Hoover Capital Conversations. I'm Lonhee Chen, the David and Diane Steffi Fellow in American Public Policy Studies at the Hoover Institution. I'm really glad today to be joined by Senator Josh Hawley, the United States Senator for Missouri. Hoover Capital Conversations is a series that we have here at the Hoover Institution where we bring together policymakers and those of us here at Hoover who are seeking to formulate ideas and help to influence the public policy dialogue for conversations about a whole set of current issues that are of interest to the American people. And certainly we're very excited today to have Senator Hawley with us, one of the true thinkers in the United States Senate, one of the country's leading constitutional lawyers, in fact, recently mentioned as a potential candidate for the United States Supreme Court, although as I understand it, Senator Hawley is very, very happy in his day job. We're very delighted to have you with us. Senator Hawley, thanks for joining us.
So much for having me.
I want to start today. Obviously, the Hoover Institution is based at Stanford. Many members of the Stanford community are joining us for our conversation today, including a former Judge Mike McConnell, who I know you're very familiar with, my Hoover colleague, who's joining us and very excited for this conversation today. But college campuses today probably look a little different than in a lot of ways than they may have looked even just 10 or 15 years ago. The rise of cancel culture, the rise of college campuses, and the prevalence of progressive thought really kind of overwhelming a lot of the freedom of expression and discussion that college campuses and communities really ought to be known for. I want to start with a question for you, Senator, about maybe how we got here and how it is that you think we can address this challenge and this concern that we're seeing on so many college campuses now across America, particularly as people go back to school, hopefully, and go back to college campuses.
Well, I think you're right that it certainly has changed. I think we've seen a significant change just in the last 2 years. You know, when I was in college, the big question was intellectual diversity. This is what conservative students in particular were often pushing for. And there were some on the left who were open to this. Said, yeah, we should have a more diverse campus climate, a more intellectually diverse faculties and so on. We are way past that now. I mean, now it's not a question of intellectual diversity. It's whether there can actually be open speech on campus. Can viewpoints, conservative viewpoints, libertarian viewpoints, can these even be heard? Actually, in many cases, traditional liberal viewpoints, can these even be heard in the classroom? Can they even be heard from the faculty? You know, I've also served as a member of a university faculty, law school faculty, for 4 years. And, I think you're seeing more and more at the faculty level, intense pressure for professors to toe the line. And it is increasingly, it's progressive, but there's also creeping into this influences from, frankly, if we're going to name names, Marxist influence, sort of neo-Marxist, social Marxism. That is becoming has been really prevalent and had a foothold in academia for years, is becoming increasingly influential theoretically in terms of it. You see this in the various critical theories, which many of which have influenced roots in Marxism and sort of neo-Marxism from the mid to late 20th century. And this is really driving, I think, a loss of free speech, open debate on campuses, and that's ultimately very bad for the country.
You've talked about this notion of the march to Marxism. I think it's a great term. It's something that we see not just in our universities and colleges, but in communities across America. And one of the ways in which we've seen that has been, frankly, the chaos in some of America's big cities, the degree to which law enforcement in many situations has been outright disrespected. You have sponsored legislation to give every law enforcement officer in America a raise. I know it's an issue you care about deeply. What's it going to take for us to reverse some of this trend that we're seeing? And is it something that public policy alone can do?
Well, public policy certainly has a role to play. And that's one of the reasons I think it's an important statement to make, and also it's important policy to embrace that we support our law enforcement. I do think that police are underpaid systematically, to use that word, in this country, and we have too few cops. I think you can see that now as you look around the country, you look at communities in St. Louis, in my own state, 9 officers have been shot in the line of duty since June. 9 since June. It is open season on police, and that is a direct result of ideas. And so I think it's important to rally public support for law enforcement and in defense of these things that we hold in common, like support for the rule of law, support for due process, and for constitutional norms, which is really what we're fighting over here. I think at a larger remove, what else needs to happen? We're going to have to confront the ideas that are behind much of the modern left, the radical left, that we're seeing gain greater and greater voice in politics in this country, already firmly entrenched on campuses, as we've been discussing. And those ideas from the modern left about structural oppression, structural racism, intersectionality, and so forth, we're going to have to confront those at an intellectual level and show why they're wrong, and show that they're wrong as a matter of history in terms of the history of this country. This country is not a systematically racist nation, but we're also going to have to expose the fact that these ideas are built on a framework, an intellectual framework, that is fundamentally Marxist in terms of its materialism, that is fundamentally, I think, outmoded and mistaken. And we're going to have to confront that and say, listen, there is a better way here. There's a better way to think about this country. There's a better understanding of our history. And we're going to have to embrace the project of calling Americans back to embrace the things that we love together. One of the things that concerns me the most about the radical left right now is that it is a politics of division. It is a politics of really of righteousness in terms of self-righteousness, really promoting this idea that unless you absolutely toe the party line, unless you are down the line embracing all, you know, this is even in the racism context, it's not enough to be against racism. You have to be, quote, anti-racist, which actually then becomes an ideological agenda. And folks who use that phrase have a particular ideological agenda that they want you to embrace. I think this turns out to be very divisive. The left is pushing a very divisive program. We need to call Americans back to embrace the things that we love and cherish together. We need a movement of national unity around our shared history, the best aspects of it. It's only when we do that that we can confront the challenges that we absolutely do face as a nation, including those challenges that we inherit from our history.
I want to remind our audience that they can submit questions through the Q&A function, and we'll do our best to get those to Senator Hawley. You've talked about all the different ways in which this march to Marxism is impacting future generations as well, and on college campuses. It's impacting people as they look at the media, as they look at various things that might be around them. What are some other ways that you see people who agree with you and agree with this notion of a need for a broader dialogue around whether it's political issues or civil society issues? How does that happen? You know, what are the venues and the fora where that can happen?
Well, we're going to have to try and reclaim space on university campuses and to make it clear that we can have it, to make it a reality where students can actually go and have open, honest discussion and debate without being shouted down, without having their viewpoints shut out. I think it's vital, for instance, that the federal government make it clear that, you know, if universities are not going to provide actual free and open debate, if they're not going to abide by the norms and values of the First Amendment, then they probably shouldn't be getting federal funding. I mean, that's my own view. Listen, universities in this country subsist on federal funding. They could not exist without federal funding. I think it's time we made very clear that they should be expected to allow a robust diversity of viewpoints to be discussed, to be open, and that the sort of viewpoint discrimination that has become all too common on university campuses is something that we're simply not going to be in the business of funding with taxpayer dollars. If they want to do that, they can do that on their own dime, but they shouldn't expect taxpayer funding. So I think that's one place to start. We've also got to claim space in the media. This is why I think independent media voices are so important. Hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about big tech here a little bit in a bit. But one of the things that's worrisome about the concentration we're seeing in the tech space is that that really also means concentration in the publisher space. When it comes to publishers, we need more independent publishers. We need more websites out there with independent viewpoints. We need more forums for discussion, not fewer. And so I'm very concerned by the trend we see in academia, in media, in the digital space toward consolidation, and consolidation with a very rigid ideological point of view.
You mentioned big tech. That's kind of where I want to go next, because unfortunately, I do think that in a variety of different online media, what we have seen is an increasing desire not to promote a diversity of viewpoints, but frankly, to push a particular agenda. Nowhere in my mind was that more apparent than this week when YouTube made the decision to remove a video interview that we did here at Hoover with one of my colleagues, Scott Atlas, who's now advising President Trump on COVID-19 response and doing so very ably. Unfortunately, YouTube took issue with one particular thing that he said that's a contested issue and used that to remove that video, while at the same time, they've kept up videos from the World Health Organization that say masks don't work, or that also sort of various contested statements as well. I know you've been a real leader on this issue, so I want to give you lots of time and space to talk about various points. But the first question is, in what ways have the federal government, through public policy that's been enacted in the past, in what ways has the federal government essentially led us to this situation? In what ways have we been brought here so that the tech companies have this ability to discriminate?
Yeah, I think you've got to go back and begin certainly with Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act back in the 1990s. You know, that act, as the title suggests, the Decency Act, was formed actually to try and reduce the amount of pornography and other quote-unquote indecent material online. And the thinking was that in order to incentivize the then nascent tech industry, these there weren't really platforms then, but some of these online companies, in order to incentivize them and indeed to protect them as they carried out the statutory obligations to take down porn and other material of that nature, that Congress would give them protections so that they couldn't be sued when they moderated content. In other words, they wouldn't be treated like a traditional publisher in moderating content, because Congress wanted to give them the protections to take down that kind of indecent material. Well, that was a long time ago. The courts pretty promptly struck down the various requirements for taking down pornographic and other indecent material, and that left the tech industry, the digital world, with these protections under Section 230, which courts then turned around and made even more robust. Mm-hmm. They actually strengthened the protections under 230 in a series of court rulings over a decade and a half. And so what we're left with now is these tech companies behave like publishers. They do absolutely moderate content. They do increasingly apply an ideological filter. They behave more and more like newspaper editorial boards, but they can't effectively be held accountable. You can't sue them. There are no means of redress effectively for customers, for clients, for users. And that turns out to be a big problem. And when you combine that with the consolidation of the industry, you mentioned YouTube. YouTube is, of course, owned by Google. You've got Facebook and Google, who are the major players in the social media digital platform space. You've got Twitter also, but Twitter is significant, but doesn't have nearly the punch that those two companies do. And then you've got Apple as well, but Apple doesn't have quite the digital platform of Facebook and Google. So you look at Facebook and Google, their market power is enormous. Their control over the flow of information in this country is unprecedented in American history, and they are more and more actively putting their thumb on the scale in favor of their ideological agenda, whether that's taking down videos like that with Dr. Atlas, whether that is removing pro-life videos as YouTube and Instagram owned by Facebook, have done repeatedly. We're seeing more and more ideological bias. And the truth is, when you're so big and so powerful and monopolistic, it's scary and frighteningly easy to do.
So you have proposed some changes along with some colleagues of yours to Section 230. Maybe talk a little bit about what the policy response is, what the right policy response is as we sit here today.
And I think when it comes to 230 in particular, the solution that I think makes the most sense and is the easiest is pretty simple. Every platform, Facebook, Google, and their subsidiary platforms, have user agreements. I think we should make those enforceable. enforceable at law, so that individual users can go to court if there's a violation of the user agreement. What's that mean in practice? As part of the user agreement, they pledge not to discriminate. They pledge to adhere to particular content moderation guidelines. And so my proposal is those ought to be legally enforceable. So if you are someone like Dr. Atlas who is being discriminated against, you have a grievance, you feel that they have not actually abided by in an even-handed way their user agreement, you ought to be able to take them to court. So they obviously hate this proposal, they being the platforms, because it would introduce real accountability around the terms that they write. You know, the thing is, funny, that they say all the time, oh, well, we don't engage in viewpoint discrimination.
Right.
You know, we promise not to. My proposal would just make that enforceable. It would take them at their word and give the customer, the user, some real authority. We have huge bargaining power disparity here. Right now, the platforms have all the power. The user has no power. That's a huge problem from a bargaining power perspective, also a huge competition problem. So I think giving the user some real power at law would make a huge difference. Also, we've got to introduce more competition. We need more competition in these markets. We just had a hearing in the antitrust subcommittee yesterday about Google's control of the advertising market online. You know, Google has a preponderance of control in every segment of the online advertising market. So much so that if you're a small independent publisher, you rely on Google in order to get the advertisements that fund your website. And if Google decides that they don't like your site or want to shut you off, they have the power to kill you. You know, the Federalist website, a conservative website, encountered that earlier this summer. Google contacted them and said, we're going to take you off of our ad platform, mm-hmm. which meant effectively the Federalists couldn't get any money to fund their site. And why? Because NBC News had complained to Google that the Federalists was engaging in racist and discriminatory content. Totally false, but the Federalist faced the prospect of annihilation, not at the hands of a government regulator, at the hands of Google. And they could do that because they exert such control and dominance in advertising. So there's a lot of power that these companies have amassed, and whether it's online advertising, whether it's data, their control over our data, whether it's speech, we have a lot of work to do in protecting consumers and reintroducing healthy competition.
We have a question from Aiden, an interesting take on this issue, which is, what do you think about regulating social media as public utilities to ensure they preserve free expression? Do you have a view on sort of going in that direction?
Yeah, I this is something that is raised periodically. I would prefer not to do that for a couple of reasons. Typically, with a public utility, you acknowledge that bigness is here to stay, that concentration right. is here to stay. I guess it makes me an old-fashioned conservative. I actually believe in free and competitive markets. I'm amazed, by the way, at people who call themselves conservative, in some cases libertarian, how they're out there defending concentration and monopoly. I mean, it's really remarkable. You talk about harming the power and the liberty of the individual. I mean, this is why we believe in free and open competitive markets. So I think we need more competition, not less. I'm leery of government regulation that would partly take over these companies and run them like public utilities, public monopolies that would entrench their power. I think what we want to do is sort of break up some of that power, that concentration, by introducing more competition. So I think the better thing to do is to shift the balance of power back toward the users when it comes to speech by giving them the option to go to court and to say, I was discriminated against. They haven't abided by their terms of service. That would be a targeted repeal of Section 230 that I think would be tremendous. And then for competition, we need to give people power over their own data. We need to require the companies to embrace interoperability protocols. So people, that just means people can transfer. If you decide, hey, I want to take all my Facebook information, I want to go to a competitor, they should be able to do that. They, the consumer, us, ought to be able to do that with ease. That would help introduce more competition. And every American, should have the right not to be tracked if they don't want to be. Right now, the way these companies make their money is they track us around the web without our consent, and then they sell ads to us. Every American ought to have the right to say, I don't want to be tracked. I want to have my own personal information remain private. That, I can tell you, would force a huge business model change in Silicon Valley.
You know, Senator, a lot of these ideas you're talking about are common sense ideas, it seems to me. A question about the politics here. I would guess that there might even be a few progressives who agree with you on the need for some of these changes and reforms. Do you think there's the hope of any kind of a bipartisan agreement on pieces of the agenda that you've laid out?
I sure hope so. And I think you're right. You know, if you look at my own legislative work in this area, I've introduced a series of bills in the tech space relating to Section 230, relating to privacy, relating to data transfer and interoperability. And a majority of those have Democrat co-sponsors. I mean, my main partner in the effort has been a Democrat. And I think that that is a tremendously positive. And I hope that we can continue to build consensus. I will tell you, but in the short year and a half that I've been in Washington, I've seen a very significant change on this issue. You know, I first started to talk about the need to reform Section 230 a year ago. I couldn't get any takers. I mean, I couldn't get anybody to sign on to that. Now you see on both the Democrat and the Republican side, especially, you see multiple people coming up. Senator Graham recently has come out and said, you know what, we do need to reform Section 230 to deal both with child, indecent child material, sexual exploitative child material, as well as the speech issue, the freedom of speech issue. So I think we're seeing a consensus begin to grow, and I hope that that will lead to bipartisan support. Because I do think that there is, if you look at our recent antitrust hearings, for example, you'll see bipartisan expressions of concern about the size and concentration of power of these companies.
One of the areas where we're seeing an increasing overlap between technology and national security issues is with respect to China. And certainly recently, this has been front and center with the news about TikTok and the president's order that if TikTok wants to continue doing business in the United States, they're going to have to really fundamentally change what they're doing. What concerns do you have about what we've heard about potential dealings between Oracle and TikTok? Do you think this is the right approach? Fundamentally, should TikTok be in the United States? Should it be here as a platform that more and more people are using?
Should it be here in its current form? I mean, I don't think there's much doubt about that. It's a huge security threat for a number of reasons. Number one, it collects way more data than it needs to run the app. I mean, if you've got TikTok on your phone, TikTok is monitoring your keystrokes. It's monitoring your location. It's monitoring your browsing history. It has access to your contact list. Almost none of that is actually needed by TikTok to make the app perform. Why do they want all that data? Well, because they want it for their algorithm, which is hugely, hugely profitable and can be used for all manner of things. So that's point one. Point two is, of course, TikTok is owned by a Chinese parent company that has senior CCP, Chinese Communist Party members in its leadership. That is required under Chinese law, required to share data, our data, with the Chinese Communist Party. And that has pledged, the company's name is ByteDance, that has pledged to cooperate fully with the CCP and to follow its agenda. All of this is public. Those are massive security threats, not just from a military point of view, although it is a military threat, and that's why the Pentagon has instructed all of its service members to remove TikTok from their phones, urge them to take it off their children's phones as well. But it's also a threat to everyday Americans. China is very hungry for data on everyday Americans. The Equifax breach perpetrated by China to try to get our personal information. They've built a repressive surveillance state in Beijing, unlike any the world has ever seen. And now they want to gather in the same style as they've done with their own citizens. They want to gather as much data on Americans as possible. It is absolutely incumbent on the federal government to make sure TikTok is not part of that effort and is not used and hijacked as part of that effort.
Beyond TikTok, there are other efforts engaged in by the Chinese Communist Party to curry influence and curry favor here in the United States. Some of those are overt, some of them are more covert or subvert. What are the different ways that policymakers, and you've been involved in some of these efforts, I mean, how do we begin to push back on some of this activity that is very concerning and frankly has been going on kind of underneath our noses now for many, many years?
Well, when it comes to the technology space and access to Americans' data, I think it's time that we put in place some very clear parameters. If a company is owned by a Chinese parent company or owned by a parent company from any state that is listed as a national security, data security threat to this country, that would certainly include China, Russia would be on that list, probably Iran, some others. If a company is owned by them, then that means under U.S. law, or should mean, that the company cannot collect any more data from American citizens than is strictly necessary to run the application, number one. Number two, they should not be able to transfer any of that data out of country. I think we ought to put these restrictions in place immediately. And number three, going forward, I think that the Treasury Department, CFIUS, the CFIUS Council that reviews the National Security Review process, that reviews foreign acquisitions after the fact for national security concerns, I think there should be a CFIUS pre-clearance review. The truth is, the TikTok arrangement that we have now should never have come to pass in the first place. We shouldn't be in this situation. ByteDance should not have been able to acquire control of Musical.ly in the way that it did. We shouldn't have ended up in this position. CFIUS only has the power, though, to do a after-the-fact, post-facto review. They ought to be able to do pre-clearance. I think that would be a big step forward in the digital space. More broadly, though, Lonnie, I think that, look, the conflict with China is going to be the defining foreign policy conflict for us, maybe the defining economic conflict of the 21st century for all of our lifetimes. We're going to have to get used to the fact that China is a competitor and an opponent. They're not going to be liberalized. Our policy, we should give up the dream of attempting to liberalize China by giving them all of our jobs and by giving them all of our technology. You know, we tried that for the last 20 years. It has not worked out. We're going to have to now enter this, embrace this era of competition that we are in with China economically, technologically, militarily, and we're going to need a coherent strategy across all those domains to do that.
One of the issues that's been in the news recently with respect to China is the sort of brutal suppression of racial and ethnic minorities in Western China. I know this is an issue that you've also spoken out on, the repression of the Uyghur minority in the Xinjiang province. I guess the question here is, there's atrocity going on, and that breaks our hearts, certainly. But why should Americans be concerned about human rights violations that are taking place thousands of miles away in a country where, you know, we probably expect they're happening anyway? I mean, I guess the question I get asked a lot, and I hear a lot in the conversation around this, is why does it matter? Why does it matter that we say something about this?
Well, for one, because it affects our jobs and it affects our security. I mean, Apple, for instance, reportedly uses Uyghur labor in the assembly or in the making, the manufacturing of its components for its various products, including its iPhone line of products. They're not alone. Nike famously, infamously, uses Chinese forced labor, slave labor, in their products. Now, these are products that could be made in the United States and that I would argue should be part of our policy to seek a way to return those supply chains. Certainly our critical medical and technological supply chains to this country. So this isn't just a matter of theory. This is something that is affecting Americans right now. It's also a matter of our national security. I mean, what China is doing with its concentration camps is a window into their designs globally. And the truth is, China would like to be in control of the Indo-Pacific theater, the Asia-Pacific theater. They want to be the dominant power, the hegemon. And from there, they want to become the hegemon of the entire world. And there's only one country that stands in their way. That's us. And we've got to make it our business to continue to stand in their way, because the kind of authority and power and domination you see them exercising in the Xinjiang province, you see them exercising in Hong Kong, is exactly the kind of power they want to project across the Asia Pacific and ultimately the globe. And that is something that we have got to stand across and say, we're not going to allow it to happen.
You mentioned the sort of some of the failures maybe in the way we've perceived our economic policy as it pertains to China, trade, how we've thought about those issues. One of the things that I found noteworthy about your time in the Senate so far is the degree to which you've been willing to question some of the conventional wisdom around economic policy amongst those of us who are free market oriented, those of us who believe in the power of markets to raise up individuals and to create economic mobility. Maybe talk a little bit about your macro level vision for what a conservative economic policy ought to look like going forward, whether it's trade or whether more domestically centered issues as well.
I think we've got to start by asking ourselves what kind of a country we want to live in. And then we build our policy around that. You know, we believe conservatives, those of us who call ourselves conservatives, traditionally believe in free markets and free enterprise, because we believe that that is what empowers individuals, families, and neighborhoods, and actually allows people to secure and live out the blessings of liberty. So I think we've got to ask ourselves in a practical way, what kind of a country is it we want in the 21st century? One of the huge problems we face right now is lack of opportunity over recent decades for folks who don't have four-year college degrees, for folks who belong to the working class of our country, who don't have as many skills, who get classed as medium or low-skilled workers, is what economists call them. We've seen job opportunities, income opportunities for those folks decline, and in many communities dry up. That happens in rural areas like the one that I grew up in. It happens in the urban core. It happens all across this country. So I think that going forward, if we want to have a society that is truly equal, if we want to have a society where every member can be have a contributing stake, they can have a real stake in the society, can participate in this project of self-government that we are in together, we're going to need to craft an economic policy that gives economic opportunity to every single member of our society, and not just those who have won the 21st century lottery by going to a four-year college or getting a graduate degree. I've got nothing against those folks. I'm one of those folks, but that's not most people in this country. Over 70% of people in this country do not complete a four-year degree. They shouldn't have to in order to get a good job. They shouldn't have to in order to start a family. They shouldn't have to in order to have a secure neighborhood. I think the vision of democracy in this nation is that it's the normal, ordinary man and woman who are the backbone of the country, who should be able to participate meaningfully in democracy and in the running of our government, and who also ought to have a say in our culture and our society. That means they've also got to have economic power. So we need to craft, I think, our economic agenda around making sure that our workers have a real shot, that they have a real stake, and they have a real future. And I would build out from there. That would control and inform my views on trade policy, my views on tax policy, my views on education policy.
Should we be doing more? Is there more that policymakers should be doing to support family and family creation and support for those who want to really make that the center of their livelihood?
Yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, there needs to be a change in D.C. at least. What I find in D.C. is that what's happened, maybe even especially on the conservative side, what's happened in the last 20 or 30 years is that the focus of our policy efforts have been the people who want to go off and get those degrees, who maybe want to start a business, who aspire to live in the upper middle or upper class economically in this country. That's fine, but let's recognize that's not most people, and it doesn't need to be. You know, we need to have a policy that's oriented towards folks whose ambition is to live in the town where they grew up, to marry their high school sweetheart, and who want their family to be the focus of their life. They don't want to start a company. They don't want to move to another state. They want to live right where they are. You know, that's most Missourians. That's most of the people that I represent. That's most of the folks. I grew up in a very small town. That's most of the folks who I grew up with. That's most of my family. There's nothing wrong with that. And we as conservatives, you know, there's something deeply conservative actually about affirming that way of life and those aspirations and saying that, yeah, those aspirations are as valuable and indeed as important to the future of this country as those who want to be part of the entrepreneur class and those who want to go off and start companies and live that life. So I think we've got to embrace policies that do that. So that's the general answer to your question is yes. And I think we've got to think about policies that remove penalties for marriage, that help families with child rearing, that encourage family formation, and that help people, I cannot emphasize enough, help folks get good paying jobs in the areas where they live. And that is absolutely vital. And I think we've got to make that a central piece, the central piece of our economic agenda.
I think the case you're making really is a compelling one in the sense that it comes back to a bias that's arisen in our culture, American culture, to a certain degree, that there is a right pathway or a right answer in terms of what career opportunities, educational opportunities, you know, things that people ought to do with their lives. And it comes back to the conversation we had initially, which is the dominant and overbearing role that institutions like the media, educational institutions have in defining what is culturally right and wrong. What gives you hope that this tide can be turned? Because I'll tell you, being on a college campus most days, at least pre-COVID, you know, there's not a lot of hope necessarily that we're headed in the right direction. But are there things that give you hope, examples of things that you think, hey, you know, we should remain hopeful that we can turn the tide in this regard?
You know, last fall I had the opportunity, before COVID, of course, had the opportunity to travel all over the state of Missouri and to spend time with folks who are not in the news. These are folks who are trying to hold down multiple jobs, who are part of that working class that's so important to my state and to this country, who wouldn't otherwise get media attention. And I just went and spent a portion of my summer traveling and talking, you know, not for media purposes, just to hear from them, just to go and hear from them. I have to tell you, it was hugely encouraging, because when I had asked them things about, you know, well, listen, here you're in a town, again, a lot like the town I grew up in, very small town, why'd you choose to stay here? And they would say things like, because my family is here, because my friends are here, and because I love this place. And what I encountered over and over again was a great love for their local community and a great love for this nation. And I have to tell you that in those communities and in this those groups of people who I believe are the majority of this country, there is an intense love for this nation and an intense commitment to the local communities and friendships and neighborhoods and associations that make democracy possible. So my view is that what we need is to renew and empower those communities. It's not that we are facing, it's not that we have to build them from scratch. They're there. I think the strength of the American experiment endures. The strength of the American people endures, but it needs to be released, I think, given new opportunities to thrive and to grow. And it needs to be protected. And I think that's our challenge for the 21st century.
We got about 5 minutes left in our conversation, Senator. I want to ask you a little bit about your time in the Senate. You're relatively new to the Senate. Would love to hear kind of what's been the biggest surprise, unexpected joy maybe from your time there in Washington.
Well, I'll start with a joke. I have this joke that I love and my colleagues hate, which is that I'm currently the youngest senator. I just turned 40 recently, and that makes me the youngest in the United States Senate. And I often joke, usually when I'm talking to a college audience, I like to say that, you know, now that I'm 40, getting older, I've tried to find a new profession that'll make me feel young, and that's why I ran for the Senate, because here in the Senate, the average age is dead. So I enjoy it. After I first told that joke, a number of my colleagues heard it, and we had some interesting conversations on the floor of the Senate about it. So hopefully none of them are watching today. I will say that, you know, the Senate is an interesting place. One of the things that is a real joy is to find like-minded folks here who really love this country and they really love policy and are serious about doing their jobs as United States senators. And some of those folks are people who helped persuade me to run for the Senate in the first instance. I think of people like Senator Tom Cotton, Senator Ted Cruz, Senator Mike Lee. I serve on committees with all of those folks, consider them personal friends, get to spend a fair amount of time with them personally. And I could go on. Those are just folks who I particularly collaborate with quite a bit. And, you know, each of those individuals so committed to doing the work of the United States Senate and to generating new ideas to try and actually provide fresh leadership. But that's really exciting. And I think to be around folks who are, by and large, you know, my colleagues, and this across the aisle too, very serious about their responsibilities and very serious about trying to provide constructive leadership. And that's been a wonderful thing to discover. And it's a great atmosphere to work in.
One of the topics that's been talked about a lot recently with respect to the Senate is the filibuster. People sort of, some argue it's antiquated, some believe it's essential to the essence of the Senate, to keeping it what it is. Do you have a view on the filibuster and whether it ought to continue?
I have to say, I don't love the filibuster. Which probably puts me in the minority of my party currently. I don't love the procedural apparatus that has grown up around the filibuster, the traditional filibuster, which has changed over time in the United States Senate. But I think we're at a point now, you can see procedurally, where very little gets done in the United States Senate without 60 votes. Part of this is due also to the budget process, to be frank with you. I mean, the budget is the biggest thing the Senate does every year. The Senate budgeting process is totally broken. The 1974 Budget Act, the Senate hasn't followed, even attempted to follow that act since 1996. I was 16 years old in 1996. I mean, this has been a little while ago. That process, which structures so much of our business in the Senate, it's just fundamentally broken. And here's the bottom line on that. You have 100 senators, 435 House members, but there's really only four people who matter for the budget for the United States of America on the congressional side. It's the Senate Majority Leader, the Senate Minority Leader, the Speaker of the House, and maybe the House Minority Leader, although the minority House has few rights, and the President of the United States. That's it. Everybody else could essentially go home. They play no meaningful role. This, from an institutional point of view, and I would argue from a Democratic point of view, this is a problem. I know we've got some historians who are, I think you said my old boss, Michael McConnell, may be watching us, and I know that Judge McConnell will know, and many others, that, how did we get parliaments in the first place? It was to control the spending, to protect the people's money. And so now we have evolved the process in this government where only four people essentially matter in a real way. Yes, we get to vote at the end, but the meaningful deliberation control done by a small handful of people, that is dysfunction. That's not the result of any one person or some nefarious cabal. That's the result of institutional dysfunction over many years. So I think that we need to think about systemic reform in the United States Senate. The filibuster is part of that, but I think a lot of times when people think about the difficulties, the dysfunctions of the Senate, it actually has to do with the overall shape of our business. And I think there's no doubt that there needs to be some serious reforms.
So I want to close today with one last question. It comes from Larry. We started with Stanford. I'm going to end with Stanford and ask you, how do you think your time at Stanford did or didn't prepare you for what you're doing today and the kind of activity you're doing today? And any advice for any Stanford undergraduates who might be watching today?
Well, I loved my time at Stanford. I learned a lot there. I was challenged there. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to go to Stanford, being a kid from small town in the Midwest, is that I wanted the challenge. I knew it was a liberal place and it did not disappoint. And I knew I'd be challenged. I knew I would have to defend myself. I knew I would be pushed. It was also at that time to a place that really welcomed robust debate, open debate, which may have changed, I think, in these intervening years. But I was pushed. I was challenged in my time there. It made me really think through my core beliefs and to get comfortable defending those. And I really was well taught. I was tremendously well taught at Stanford. To take just one example, Professor David Kennedy, the history department, now emeritus, so I think David still teaches, which is tremendous. David was one of the first professors I had as a freshman. He supervised my research that I began as a freshman. And all 4 years helped guide me through my studies. I learned so much from David. He would probably want me to say that our politics are very different. I think he would demand, in fact, that I put that out, which is true, but partly for that reason. Then the back and forth with him, learning how to think like a historian, learning to take seriously opposing viewpoints, learning how to do research, learning how to put yourself in the shoes of those in the past, and then how you learn from mistakes that were made in the past and think about what that means for the future. I'd learned a tremendous amount from him and from his colleagues in the history department about how to think. He never tried to teach me what to think, but he was very interested in teaching me how to think like a historian in particular, but more broadly, how do you think, how do you work through problems? How do you express yourself clearly? So I was tremendously, tremendously blessed with the teachers that I had. David was just one, there were many, But he's one who certainly has influenced a significant, or exerted a significant amount of influence on my life direction. And I'm grateful to him and for all of those who taught me there at Stanford.
Well, we appreciate the time you've taken today to spend a little bit of your day with us and talk about these important issues. Thank you, Senator Hawley, for joining us on Hoover Capital Conversations. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll have another Capital Conversation soon. Go to hoover.org/capitalconversations for more. Have a great day. Mm-hmm.